the end, all we could think about was how they tasted. None of us ate each other, Ivy said. But you thought about it, Aida said with a smile. Dinah slammed her palm hard on the table. She sat still for a moment with her eyes closed tight, then stood up and walked out of the room.
I guess she is not disciplined or intelligent enough to control her aggression,
Aida cracked.
It is a form of self-discipline, Tekla said, so that she would not kill you. You see, Aida, thinking about doing such things and doing are different. This is why greater discipline is a requirement.
Sweetie, what do you mean when you speak of discipline? Moira asked. I'm just trying to cash that word out in terms of genetics. I can find a genetic marker for cystic fibrosis. I'm not sure if the same is true of discipline.
Some races are disciplined, is fact, Tekla said. Japanese are more disciplined than Italians.
She gave Aida a stare that would have frozen most people to their chairs, but Aida just threw her head back and laughed exultantly.
You are forgetting the Roman legions, but please, go on.
Men are more disciplined than women, is just fact. So, there must be genes for it.
This produced yet another silence, eventually broken by Louisa. I'm seeing a side of you I didn't know about, Tekla.
Call me bad. Call me racist if you want. I know what you will say. That it is all training. It is all culture. I disagree. If you do not feel pain, you do not respond to pain and hormones.
What about hormones, lover? Moira asked. Her affection for Tekla was obvious and took some of the tension out of the room.
We all know that when hormones are a certain way, emotions have big impact. Other times, not so much. This is genetic.
Or maybe epigenetic. We really don't know, Moira said.
Whatever, Tekla said. My point is that for people to live in tin cans for hundreds of years requires order and discipline. Not from above, from within. If there is a way to make this easier with your genetic lab, then we should do it.
Louisa said, We never explored Ivy's point that intelligence was key.
Yes, Ivy said, with a glance at Aida. I was interrupted.
Aida covered her mouth with her hand and sniggered theatrically. Ivy went on,
If we are really going to open the door to genetic improvement of our offspring, then it seems obvious to me that we should look to the one quality that trumps all others, and that is clearly intelligence.
What do you mean it trumps all others? Louisa asked.
With intelligence, you can see the need to show discipline when the situation calls for it, or to act aggressively, or not. I would argue that the human mind is mutable enough that it can become all of the different types of people that Camilla, Aida, and Tekla have been describing. But that's all driven by what separates us from the animals, which is our brains.
There are many different types of intelligence, Louisa said. Ivy gave a little shake of her head.
I've seen all of that stuff about emotional intelligence and what have you. Okay, fine. But you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you know it can be propagated genetically. Just look at the academic records. The test scores of the Ashkenazi Jews.
Speaking as a Sephardic Jew, Louisa said, you can imagine my mixed feelings.
We need brains, is the bottom line, Ivy said. We're not hunter-gatherers anymore. We're all living like patients in the intensive care unit of a hospital. What keeps us alive isn't bravery or athleticism or any of those other skills that were valuable in a caveman society. It's our ability to master complex technological skills. It is our ability to be nerds. We need to breed nerds.
She turned to look at Aida full in the face. You ask for realism. Your complaint about her, she nodded at Julia, and the people around her was that they were holding out panaceas.
not facing facts. Fine. I'm giving you facts. We're all nerds now. We might as well get good at it.
Aida shook her head in derision.
You completely leave out the human component. It's why you are a bad leader. It's why you were replaced by Marcus, when wiser people than you were in control. And it's why we are here.
Here, safe and sound, Ivy said, unlike the people who followed you, all of whom are dead.
So they are, Aida said, and I am alive, and I can see how it's going to be. You are going to keep Amiya locked up in an arklet, making genetic freak babies and taking them away from me.
And she broke down weeping. She has what I have, except worse, Julia explained. She sees many outcomes, most of which, given the circumstances, are dark, then acts upon them.
What an unusual degree of introspection from you, Julia,
Moira said.
You have no concept of my level of introspection,
Julia shot back.
I have been clinically depressed for most of my life. I once used drugs to fix it. Then I stopped. I stopped because I decided they were making me stupid, and I'd rather be miserable than stupid. I am what I am.
Depression is genetically based, to some extent. Would you like me to erase it from your children's genomes?
Moira asked.
You heard what I said, Julia answered. You know now the decision I made, which was to suffer for the greater good, because society will go astray if there are not those who, like me, imagine many outcomes. Let those scenarios run rampant in their minds. Anticipate the worst that could happen. Take steps to prevent it. If the price of that, the price of having a head full of dark imaginings, is personal suffering, then so be it.
But would you wish that on your progeny?
Of course not,
Julia said. If there were a way to have one without the other, the foresight without the misery, I would take it in a heartbeat.
We only need a few people of this mentality, Tekla said. Too many, and you get the Soviet Union.
I am 47, Julia said. I have one baby in me, if I'm lucky. The rest of you can punch them out for 20 years. Do the math.
It amazes me that we have already gone over to the competitive angle,
Camilla wailed.
I am so sorry that I brought this topic up.
A sharp rapping noise brought the room to attention. Heads turned toward the banana's window. It was not large, about the size of a dinner plate. For 3 years it had been buried in ice and forgotten about. But now it afforded a clear, if somewhat dizzying, view of their surroundings. Outside of it, carabinered to the spinning torus, was Dinah. She had put on a spacesuit and gone out through an airlock. Seeing she had their attention, she reached up and slapped a small object onto the glass. It was a lump of clay, some wires, and an electronic gadget. She depressed a button on the gadget, and it began to count down from 10 minutes. Aida screamed with laughter and clapped her hands.
What on earth is she doing?
Julia asked.
That's a demolition charge, Ivy said. It's going to kill us all 10 minutes from now if she doesn't take it off the window.
She turned to survey the room.
Well, what is her point?
Julia demanded. I think my friend is trying to tell us that if we can't settle this in 10 minutes, the human race doesn't deserve to go on existing, Ivy said. They all sat silently for perhaps half a minute before Moira said,
How's this? Every woman decides what is going to be done with her eggs.
Hearing no objection, she continued,
Oh, let me be clear. If it's a real disease, something on the books, defined in the medical literature as such, then I will fix it, with no distinctions made between physical and mental disorders. No matter how many of those conditions each of you may be suffering from, I will fix them all before taking any other action. However, and she smiled and held up an index finger, once all that is done, each of us gets a free one.
Free what?
Tekla asked.
One alteration, one improvement,
of your choice, applied to the genome of the fertilized ovum that will grow into your child, and your child only. You cannot force it on any of the others. So, Camilla, if you think it would improve the human race to get rid of its aggression, why then, I will search through the scientific literature for a way to reach toward your goal genetically, and likewise for the rest of you, and whatever changes you happen to think will improve the human condition. Your child, your choice. They all considered it, glancing at one another from time to time, each trying to gauge the other's reactions. Ivy glanced at the timer outside. Are there any questions? We have 8 minutes remaining. Louisa said, I don't think we need 8 minutes. Ivy looked each of them in the eye, then turned toward the window and gave a thumbs up. Dinah's eyes, seen through the glass of the window and the dome of her spacesuit's helmet, pivoted to focus on that. She nodded. Moira smiled and put her thumb up. This, too, was noted by Dinah. Then Tekla, then Louisa, Camilla, Julia. All eyes were on Aida. She would not look back at them. She was, at bottom, very shy. Whatever, she mumbled. She needs to see your vote, Ivy said.
Really? You mean that I could single-handedly destroy the entire human race simply by not putting my thumb up in the next 7 minutes?
Tekla pulled a folding knife from a pocket in her coverall and flicked the blade open. She kept it low, down in her lap, and pretended to clean a fingernail with it.
Either that, Tekla said, or population of human race suddenly goes from 8 to 7, and we have unanimous decision.
Smiling, Aida thrust her hand out, thumb down.
I pronounce a curse, she said.
Louisa let out an exasperated sigh.
This is not a curse that I create. It is not a curse on your children, no. I have never been as bad as you all think that I am. This is a curse that you have created by doing this thing that you are about to do. It is a curse upon my children, because I know. I see how it is to be. I am the evil one, the cannibal, the one who would not go along. My children, no matter what decision I make, will forever be different from your children, because make no mistake.
What you have decided to do is to create new races.
7 new races. They will be separate and distinct forever. As much as you, Moira, are from Ivy. They will never merge into a single human race again, because that is not the way of humanity. Thousands of years from now, the descendants of you six will look at my descendants and say, Ah, look! There is a child of Aida, the cannibal, the evil one, the cursed one. They will cross the street to avoid my children. They will spit on the ground. This is the thing that you have done by making this decision. I will shape my child, my children, for I shall have many to bear up under this curse, to survive it, and to prevail.
Aida swept her gaze around the room, staring with her deep black eyes into the face of each of the other women in turn, then looked into the window and locked eyes with Dinah.
I pronounce it, she said,
then slowly rotated her hand until her thumb was pointed up. Dinah peeled the demolition charge away from the window. She had no idea what Aida had just said, nor did she especially care. It would be the usual histrionic Aida stuff. Several minutes remained on the countdown timer. She could have simply turned it off, but she felt like going for a walk. Whatever had just happened in the banana looked unpleasant. She was tired of being cooped up with these people, even the ones she loved. She felt no great compulsion to rejoin them. She unclipped the carabiner and let go of the lazily spinning Taurus. Her momentum carried her toward the wall of the crevasse. Long accustomed to movement in zero-G, she timed a slow somersault and planted her feet on the wall to kill her speed, then turned on the magnets in her boots and began hiking up the crevasse wall. The weak gravity made directions arbitrary. Walking vertically up a cliff, was little different from walking horizontally along the canyon floor. A tone sounded from the speakers in her helmet, alerting her that a voice connection had been made. It was Ivy.
Going for a stroll?
Yeah.
Look, we just realized something.
Oh?
We all voted except for you.
Good point.
Dinah glanced down at the countdown timer. The screen was getting more difficult to read, since she was nearing the Terminator. The knife-sharp line between sunlight and shadow, and the bright canyon wall above her was reflecting from the screen. Tilting it for a better view, she saw that it was just about to drop through the 60-second mark.
It's okay. I still have a minute to make my decision.
Well, do you want to know what the rest of us agreed on?
I trust you, but sure.
We're all going to try to have babies just like you, Dinah.
Very funny.
Dinah crossed over the Terminator, and the sun rose. She raised her free hand and flipped down the sun visor on her helmet.
Moira's working on it now.
Is that why Aida was being such a drama queen about it?
Exactly. 35 seconds.
What did you really decide?
One free gene change for each mommy.
Oh, yeah? So what are you going to do? Make really smart little straight-arrow bitches?
How'd you guess?
Just an intuition.
What about you, Dinah?
Dinah could hear the beginnings of anxiety in her friend's voice. She looked down into the crevasse, saw humanity's cradle welded helplessly into place. Imagined for a moment throwing the demolition charge down on it, like a vindictive goddess hurling a lightning bolt. She was thinking of Marcus, of the kids she should have had with him. What would they have been like? Marcus had been kind of a jerk in some ways, but he knew how to control it. Really, she now understood, what had prompted her to slam the table and get up and storm out of the bananas a few minutes ago had not been Aida at all. Aida was provocative, yes, but more infuriating had been a slow burn that had started with Camilla and her remarks about aggression. Remarks that Dinah now saw as aimed not so much at Dinah as at Marcus. She wished she could grab Camilla by the scruff of the neck and sit her down in front of a display and make her watch the way Marcus had spent the last minutes of his life. Marcus was a hero. It seemed to Dinah that Camilla wanted to strip humanity of its heroes. She'd couched what she'd said in terms of aggression, but by doing so, Camilla was just being aggressive in a different way. A passive-aggressive way that Dinah, raised as she'd been raised, couldn't help seeing as sneaky, more destructive in the end than the overt kind of aggression. It was this that had made her so flustered that she'd had to leave the meeting.
Dinah?
Ivy said.
I'm going to breed a race of heroes, Dinah said. Fuck Camilla.
It's going to be interesting, sharing confined spaces with a race of heroes for hundreds of years.
Marcus knew how to do it, Dinah said. He was a jerk, but he had a code. It's called chivalry.
She gave the demolition charge a toss straight up.
Did you just vote yes?
Oh, yeah, she said, watching it dwindle against the stars.
The red lights of the LED timer glittered like rubies.
We're unanimous, Ivy said.
Dinah understood that Ivy was announcing it to the other women in the banana.
For the first and last time, Dinah thought.
The red light had shrunk to a pinprick, like the planet Mars, she thought, except sharper and more brilliant. Then silently, it turned into a ball of yellow light that darkened as it spread.
Part 3. 5,000 years later. Kath, too, was startled awake by patches of orange-pink light cavorting across the taut fabric above her. A very old instinct, born on the savannas of old Earth, read it as danger, the flitting shadows, perhaps, of predators circling her tent. During the 5,000 years of the hard rain, that instinct had lain dormant and useless. here on the surface of New Earth, just beginning to support animals big and smart enough to be dangerous, it was once again troubling her sleep. Her shoulder twitched, in the way that it did sometimes when you were half awake and not sure whether you were really moving or dreaming of it. She had thought of reaching under her pillow for the weapon, but coming fully to, she found that her arm had not really moved, other than the twitch. Through the thin padding beneath her head, she could still feel the hard shape of the catapult. By then it had become obvious that the moving light on the tent had nothing to do with large predators. It was too dappled and volatile. Not even birds could move so. Its twinkling and swirling were mysterious, but its hue told her it was the first light of the day. This meant that she had slept a little too long and was in danger of missing the dawn breezes that she had hoped would bear her into the sky. She stumbled out of her little tent, feeling yesterday's hike in the muscles of her legs. That was surprising. She thought she had trained well. But even in the largest space habitat, you couldn't go downhill for all that long. On an actual planet, you could go on losing altitude for days. And as it turned out, those long downhill runs were what really killed your legs. Yesterday she had shed almost 2,000 meters, descending from a range of hills toward a blue, water-filled crater 30 kilometers across. She had stopped a few clicks short of its rim, where the ground dropped away toward a swath of grassland between her and the shore. The break in the slope had been subtle, but Cath-2's throbbing knees had made it obvious enough. She had taken a dozen or so strides down it, gauging its angle in her blistered soles, sensing the air's currents with her lips, her hair, and the palms of her hands. Then she had turned around and trudged back up to an inflection point that would have been invisible had the low evening sun not been grazing it, casting a sharp terminator on the ground. Where wind streamed over bent ground, it stretched. The stretching had been faint in the dying wind of yestereve, but she had known that it would become more pronounced in the morning, as the sun rose and the air fled from its warmth. So she had dropped her pack and made her camp. The source of the dappled light, as she now saw, was sunlight sparkling from waves on the lake below, shooting rays through the branches of trees. Perhaps 100 meters down the slope from her, they were beginning to stir in the morning breeze, making soft noises, as when a sleeping lover exhales. She bent down, pulled the catapult out from under the sack of laundry she'd been using as a pillow, felt it thrum as it recognized her fingerprint. After a short walk and a careful look around, for she did not actually wish to use the catapult, she squatted and urinated in the largest open space that was handy. Only in the last few decades had the ecosystem here matured to the point where Terraform, her employer, could seed it with predators. And that was always somewhat hit or miss. On the mature ecosystems of old Earth, predators and prey had, according to the histories, evolved to some kind of equilibrium. On the remade ones of New Earth, you never knew. You couldn't assume that all the predators around here were getting enough to eat, and even if they were, they might view Cath 2 as a bit of tempting variety to add to their diet. Cath 2 was survey. Whether or not this made her military was a topic of almost theological complexity. But regardless of whether you considered survey to be a purely scientific corps with ad hoc liaisons to the military, merely for logistical convenience and situational awareness, or viewed it as an elite scout unit working hand in glove with snake eaters, its stated mission was to observe and report on the growth of New Earth's ecosystem, not to kill the animals that the human races had gone to so much trouble to invent and import. During her 2-week stint on the surface, she had grown used to the catapult and stopped seeing it as remarkable that she was carrying a weapon. But the awareness that she was going home today made her see all of this through the eyes of the sophisticated urbanites she might be mingling with tomorrow, habitat ring dwellers who would never believe that only a short time earlier, Cath 2 had been in a place where one did not pee without carefully looking around first, did not venture into the open without a weapon in hand. During the minutes since she had awakened, the sparkling light had warmed to brassy gold. Everything in the scene was a combination of exceptionally complex and unpredictable phenomena. The wavelets on the lake, the shapes into which the branches of the trees had grown during the century or so since this ground had been seeded by pods hurtling down out of space, tumbling like dice on jumbled ejecta from the myriad bolide strikes of the hard rain, finding purchase in crevices prepped by rock-munching microbes. The branches and the leaves responded to the currents of the wind, which were themselves random and turbulent, in a way that surpassed human calculation. She thought about the fact that the brains of humans, or of any large animals really, had evolved to live in environments like this, and to be nourished by such complex stimuli. For 5,000 years, the people of the human races had been living without that kind of nourishment. They had tried to simulate it with computers. They had built habitats large enough to support lakes and forests. But nature simulated was not nature. She wondered if humans' brains had changed during that time, and if they were now ready for what they had set in motion on New Earth. And then, because she was a Moiran, she wondered if all that had to do with the fact that she had overslept. Her previous survey missions had been quick insertions lasting a few days, and they had typically sent her to less developed biomes, the fringes of the terraform process, where the seeding of the ground had occurred more recently, and less complexity struck the eye, nose, and ear. This mission, however, had lasted long enough that she could feel it changing her. Eve Moira had been a child of London, fascinated by the natural world, but drawn to the city. So Kath too looked to the bright lights of the big city. Here, that meant gazing up into the sky. Yesterday had been overcast, with little movements in the air. She might have been hard-pressed to find and organize the energy she would need to get home. But matters had changed during the night. The air was moving. Not strongly enough yet that she could feel it on her face, but enough to stir the leaves at the top of the trees and to wobble the heavy heads of the tall grass. Above, it must be moving more strongly, for yesterday's sheet of clouds had been shredded to tufts and tissues, purplish-gray on the bottom and pink-orange on their eastern faces. The sky between them, however, was perfectly clear, and still dark enough that she could see a few bright stars and planets. And to the south, for she was in the northern hemisphere, an orderly ring of brilliant points erupting from the eastern horizon and arching across the vault of the sky until it plunged into the shadow of the world, off to the west. From here, she could see nearly half of the 10,000 or so habitants in the ring. Far to the east, just above the horizon, was an especially big dot of light, like the clasp on a necklace. That would be the colossal structure of the Eye, currently stationed above the Atlantic. It was time to go there. She had pitched her little shelter on a flat lozenge of soft grass some distance back from the brow of the hill where the wind would soon be bending. She struck her camp, shouldered her pack one last time, and carried it a short distance to the break in the slope she had noticed yesterday. She popped the clasp on the hip belt and let it drop to the ground. Unrolling the deflated wings and the tail structure was as easy as giving each a swift kick. Smaller bundles had been stuffed between them, a foot-operated pump and a hard sphere, somewhat larger than Cath-2's head. She devoted a few minutes to stomping the pump. The wrinkles began to disappear from the splayed runs of fabric, and it began to look like a glider. The sun had cleared the opposite rim of the crater. The tops of the wings began gathering its energy and feeding it to built-in air pumps that would pressurize the wing and tail tubes beyond what could be achieved with muscle power. She got dressed, which began with getting naked and cold. She was glad she had worked up a sweat operating the pump. The hard sphere was a glass bubble with an opening at the bottom large enough to admit Cath-2's head. At the moment, though, it was stuffed with a roll of gray fabric. She withdrew this and kicked it out on the ground. It was as long as she was tall. Rolled up in it had been a semi-rigid funnel with straps dangling from its edge. Stuffed into the funnel were two packets. One of the packets was tiny, just a pill that would stop up her bowels for a day. She swallowed it. The other was a heavy and distressingly cold sack of gel. Cathtu bit off one corner and then smeared the gel all over herself, wincing at its chilly touch. It was an emollient, rumored to be very complicated, and it had an official name, but everyone called it space grease. The stuff would never be sold as a cosmetic. It lay heavy on her skin, and she could practically feel her pores clogging. The funnel and strap contraption was for collecting urine. She stepped into it, pulled it up over her pubic mound, and cinched the straps high over her pelvic crest. A short tube dangled from it, tickling her inner thigh. She then picked up the gray fabric thing. This was a one-piece bodysuit whose only opening was at the neck. It was a mesh of nearly microscopic gnats, simple three-legged robots that knew how to do very little other than hold hands with their neighbors. It would have been impossible to put on were it not for the fact that the gnats, talking to each other in a simple language, could stretch and shrink those connections according to a shared program. She got both of her hands into the neck hole and pulled opposite ways. Recognizing the gesture, the gnats relaxed, and the opening widened to the point where she could insert one foot, then the other. This required good balance, which Cathtu was fortunate enough to have. She was standing on a towel that she had spread out on the ground. The classic error was to lose one's balance and plant a foot in the dirt, or even fall down, and get covered with dirt and rocks and twigs that would stick to the space grease. But Cathtu got her feet into the suit without incident. Finding the leg holes, and then the individual toe holes, was, as usual, slapstick comedy. Once she got the suit pulled up over her buttocks, she was able to sit down and manage this one digit at a time. Then she reached down inside the still baggy thighs and connected the urine tube to a fitting on the inside of her right thigh. Recognizing as much, the fabric drew tight, nearly trapping her hands inside. The tightness moved up in a wave from toes to knees to thighs to buttocks, pausing once it had noticed her waist. She shrugged the suit's upper half on over her shoulders and got her fingers sorted into the gloves that terminated its arms. The suit, sensing what she was up to, grew tighter as she went, save at the neck. From the helmet's orifice, she detached a rigid collar with a hinge on one side and a latch on the other. She snapped it into place around her neck, then pulled the loose fabric of the suit up over it and held it in place as it shrank, forming a tight connection to the collar. From the hard collar down to her toes, she was now clad in gray material that fit her so closely she could see tendons in the backs of her hands, nipples reacting to the early morning chill, and the little valleys where her nails erupted from their beds. She hesitated to lower the helmet over her face. This would be her last opportunity for a while to breathe the fresh air of New Earth. The scientist in her was at odds with a deeper layer, common to all human races, that wanted to see beauty and purpose in the natural world. She knew perfectly well what Doc, or just about any other Ivan, would say to her if he could read her mind. The water in that lake below you is there because we crashed comet cores into the dead earth until it stayed wet. The air you're breathing was manufactured by organisms we genetically engineered and sprayed all over the wet planet, then killed once they had accomplished their task. And the sharp scent you like so much comes from vegetation that, for many years, existed only as a string of binary digits stored on a thumb drive on a string around the neck of your Eve. None of which changed the fact that she liked it. But the breeze was building, making the craft jostle and fidget. It was trimmed for minimum lift, and unlikely to go anywhere, but a sudden gust might still carry it away. Unnerved by a sudden movement, Cathtu reached out and slapped the upper surface of the right wing, about an arm's length in from the tip. Cathtu felt her own touch. A patch of skin on the back of her right forearm, a finger's length in from the wrist, thrilled as the suit's fabric contracted over it. A configuration of puckers no larger than a fingerprint, but shaped, unmistakably, like a miniature hand. Moira's hand. Her skin and that of the glider had become joined in a common sensorium, mediated by the smart fabric of the suit. It never got old. She slid her hand out toward the tip of the wing and watched with a little grin as the hand-shaped disturbance in her suit moved out toward her wrist. She lifted her hand from the wing, and the pucker vanished. She dropped the helmet over her head and got it seated in the collar. Other than a padded brow band to support the weight of her head and a sparse geodesic array of miniature speakers, the helmet was just a transparent bubble, mercifully free of heads-up displays and other clutter. In the fuselage that joined the wings was a nest barely large enough to accommodate her. She straddled the nose, lifted one knee, and nestled it into a padded and insulated gutter that would support it and her shin. Then she followed suit with the other leg. She was kneeling in the cockpit now. Resting loose on the belly pad in front of her was a parachute folded up into a slim backpack. She picked this up, slung it over her back, and tightened the straps around her waist and thighs. She leaned forward and took her weight on her arms, then did a reverse push-up, settling onto her belly. Then she made connections, the P-tube to a system that would drain it, drinking water at her collar. She didn't yet need the tubes for incoming and outgoing atmosphere, but she connected them anyway, as well as a power cable. Then she reached back behind her, all the way down to her ankles, and found the handle for the zipper. She had no idea why it was called that. It was a linear closure, consisting of more dumb, specialized gnats that sealed her body inside the fuselage, snug under many layers of crinkly insulation. As she pulled it up, she felt the glider's flexible top clamp around her buttocks and cleave together up the length of her spine until it had closed around the collar of her suit. Only her head bubble was now exposed. It had become the glider's nose cone. She extended her arms then to the sides like a bird spreading its wings, sliding them into insulated tunnels where they rested comfortably on inflated supports. For a moment, she thought that some little stones had somehow made their way on board and gotten trapped under her arms. Then one of them shifted a little, and she realized that this was the suit again, sensing the pressure of a rock on the underside of the wing and mirroring it. The insulation also helped to deaden sound, and so she could now hear almost nothing from outside. Which didn't mean she couldn't hear anything. She could hear the wind, a phrase that didn't really do justice to the soundscape now being rendered by the array of miniature speakers. The canid smelled the forest was a completely different sentence from the man smelled the forest, not because the words had different meanings, but because the canid's olfactory apparatus was infinitely superior to that of the man. In a loosely analogous way, the real-time three-dimensional sonic portrait of the wind generated by the glider's onboard systems and rendered by the helmet's speakers was as far beyond what she could sense with unaided ears as the canid's scenting of the forest was beyond the man's. For the vehicle had lidars pointed in all directions, looking out into the air to a range of several hundred meters, and seeing its myriad currents, shears, and vortices. To convey all of that information in sound was impossible, but what came through was more than enough to tell Kath, too, where she wanted to go, namely, where the energy was. And right now, the symphony of tones, whooshes, crackles, and rustlings told her that her intuition yestereve had been more or less correct. The wind climbed the slope from the lake in a fairly continuous sheet, but as it molded itself over the brow of the hill, the wind higher up, on the outside track, had to go faster in order to keep up with the ground layer. There was a gradient in speed between the wind aloft and that at the ground. She could use it. Her eyes were busy, too, tracking a pair of birds flying parallel to the slope, dipping in and out of the shear in the wind, sipping power. Far above them, the clouds were telling her a story about the conditions she'd be facing in a few minutes' time, but this was no concern of hers now. The wind gusted. The feeling of pressure beneath her arms increased, and at the same time, she felt the entire craft rising. She moved her feet and her hands in a way that the suit recognized and transmitted to the glider's control surfaces. Just that quickly, it was configured for lift. Biting suddenly into the wind coming up the hill, the craft sprang into the air. She could feel the knots of pressure vanish as the ground lost contact with the wings. Then the only sensations on the skin of her arms were caused by the wings reading the currents of air flowing over them. She let herself rise high enough to buy some margin of error, then dropped the nose and glided down the hill, trading altitude for velocity. The game she'd be playing for the rest of the day was to build up a fund of energy by stealing it from the atmosphere. At the end, she would trade it all for altitude and spiral up to a place where the atmosphere failed. Closer to the shore of the lake, the meadow gave way to trees. This was one of the more mature forests on New Earth. It had been seeded only a few years after the first treaty, about 100 years ago. She pulled the nose up, skimmed over the highest branches, then dropped again until she was gliding over the blue water of the lake, the melted core of a comet, still coming alive with seeded algae and fish. With a voice command, she caused the glider to drop a tube, no thicker than her finger, into the water skimming by a few meters below. On her first pass across the lake's diameter, she collected 20 kilograms of water, which slowed the glider down somewhat. She found a thermal on the other side and rode it up a few 100 meters before rolling over and diving down for another, faster pass over the lake and another long drink of water. This part of the journey was the most ticklish, so it was good that it came first, when she was still fresh. A glider that was light enough to carry around on her back was, by the same token, too light to store very much kinetic energy. Its lack of momentum placed limits on the maneuvers Cath 2 could perform in the higher atmosphere. Small twitches in the flow of air would bat it around like a feather. It needed to get a lot heavier. The way to do that was to scoop water out of a lake, as she was doing now. But it all happened at low altitude and low speed, where the margin for error was slender. The first few passes, when the glider weighed practically nothing, were the most delicate. So she took her time at each side of the lake to find good thermals and harvest their force. After an hour of that, however, she was dive-bombing her way across the crater with terrific authority, carrying hundreds of kilograms of ballast in the belly and the wings. By then she had learned where to hunt for thermals that, as the morning wore on, bloomed with increasing vigor from the open meadows and the shoulders of the great crater. It was on her last pass, just as she was getting ready to pull up and skim over the tops of the trees that grew from the onrushing shore, that she saw the human. The human was not exposed on the shore, but standing back among the first line of trees, apparently watching her. He or she, the distance was too great to read gender, was dressed in clothing that blended in with the surroundings. Not the bright coveralls of survey. But neither did it look military. Perhaps sensing that he or she had been spotted, the human immediately stepped back into the young forest. At the same moment, Cath too was obliged to pull her nose up, lest she collide with the trees. So great had been her surprise that she almost did it too late, and felt a few thin branches whipping against the belly of the fuselage as she put the lake behind her for good. Directly ahead was a broad meadow, angled toward the sun, that she knew to be an excellent source of power. As she drew close enough for the lidars to read the air and for her eyes to pick out the movement of the birds, she banked into the thermal. Her first approach was a crude guess based on what she was hearing, but as soon as she got into it and felt the fine-grained currents of the air in her arms and her fingertips, she was able to use it as birds did. Half an hour's climbing left the lake a blue disk far below, and put her in sight of open country to the southeast, dotted with mushroom-cap clouds that were a dead giveaway. trading altitude for distance, she glided in a nearly straight line until she could pick up those thermals and recharge her store of energy. She had her eye on a range of mountains several hundred kilometers distant, rising up above the eastern shore of the Pacific Ocean. Above them, clouds were arranged in long folds, running parallel to the crest of the range. The photocells in the wings had stored up enough power now that she was able to send a burst of data up into space. Packets coming back a few seconds later told her when and where she could expect hangars along her projected route. It was too early to lock in on a specific plan, but useful to get a general picture. And it was good practice to let people know where she was and when to expect her. It looked like about 20 other surveyors were operating in the same general zone. She considered the number astonishingly high and double-checked it. While she was waiting for confirmation to come back, she scanned the skies around her and spotted two of them. After some thought, she sent a voice message to Doc. "I want to talk to you when I get back. Not urgent, but important." Then she put such distractions out of her mind and attended to the problem at hand, which was stringing together enough thermals to get her into the mountain wave that awaited her downrange. Once she had stored enough energy in her glider, mostly in the form of altitude, the thermal riding part of it became nearly automatic, and she was able to doze off for stretches of 20 minutes at a time. In truth, there was no aspect of this flight that could not have been managed by a robot. Robot gliders were at this moment operating all over New Earth. But she was leery of letting her own powers dwindle by delegating them to machines, and so she liked to fly the glider at least part of the time. The algorithms worked, but they wouldn't get better unless humans guarded them. And to do that, you had to fly. A surge of acceleration awakened her from an early afternoon nap, and she looked down to see the snow-covered peaks of the mountains 1,000 meters below her. She had found the mountain wave, a source of sustained atmospheric power that dwarfed anything that could be obtained from thermals. It was a ridge of rising air running from north to south. If she turned north from here, she could probably ride it all the way to the polar vortex and take that up to where the atmosphere failed. But she had farther to go than wings could take her, so she banked south and trimmed the glider to slip sideways along the wave, skimming enough power from it to gain altitude even while screaming southward at 300 kilometers an hour. She was a fly hitching a ride on a hurricane. Knots in the tapestry of sound told her of other solid objects above and below, left and right. She was able to pick them out visually as the setting sun lit up their fuselages and wingtips against the deep purple of the sky. Higher yet, unfathomably far above, and yet only in low Earth orbit, were larger structures, moving more slowly, like the minute hands of great clocks. Linear constellations with fatter, brighter lights on their ends. One of them was sweeping across the sky directly south of her, and she knew she was already too late to catch it. But looking off to the west, she saw another approaching, like a giant leg striding across the sky, its foot swinging downward, not yet planted. She didn't even need to check the params to know that this was the hangar for her. But she ran the calculation anyway, partly to confirm her guess, and partly as a courtesy to other aircraft in this crowded space that might be aiming for the same one. Darkness fell before she reached it. The hangar, it was a pun on hangar, a term from old Earth aviation, was a big hollow pod hanging on the end of a tether that, just now, extended far up into space. At its opposite end, thousands of kilometers above, was another hangar just like it, serving as a counterweight. The two hangars formed a bolo, rotating around each other to keep the tether stretched tight between them. The bolo orbited the Earth just like any other satellite, the difference being that the height of that orbit and the length of the tether had been tuned so that on every rotation, or as it appeared from Cath-2's point of view, each long stride across the heavens, the hangar on the low end would swing down into the uppermost reaches of the atmosphere and seem to hover, almost still, for a minute, somewhat analogous to the way that a runner's foot will remain planted on the ground, unmoving for an instant during each stride, even though the runner is traveling swiftly. In any case, it came low enough and went slowly enough that a glider, pumped to great velocity and brought high into the atmosphere by the power of the mountain wave, could catch it and match it. Cath-2's eyes and ears told her of other vehicles converging on the same target. A few minutes prior to rendezvous, it became obligatory to hand control of the craft over to a version of the ancient program Perambulator, which managed the final approach. Cath-2 could have stuck the landing without assistance, had she been alone. But coordinating her approach with the other vehicles was the sort of task best left up to a 5,000-year-old algorithm. At the time she ceded control, the hangar still seemed impossibly far away, but over the next few minutes, it loomed out of the sky like a slow-motion meteorite, studded with red running lights. It was shaped like a rugby ball, streamlined fore and aft, with stubby winglets that were finding traction in the thin air, adjusting their angles of attack to stabilize its flight. Cath-2 and the other aircraft were converging on it from behind, overtaking it rapidly as it slowed almost to a stop. Most of the hangar's aft end was a broad aperture that now irised open to reveal a spacious deck, brightly illuminated, like a magic doorway hanging in the sky. In front of her, she could see the lights of other vehicles sidling into the queue ahead of her. The hangar's bright orifice grew huge, like a chilly sun falling out of the sky. One by one, the vehicles slipped into its lee and bounced and skidded to a stop on its deck. From a distance, this appeared level. In fact, it was angled slightly upward, so that the aircraft climbed a gentle ramp as they rolled into it. This helped them kill their excess velocity. Her glider bounced twice before the ramp took its weight. Then gravity, real and simulated, came down like a fat hand on her back, and she felt a rush of blood to the head as the glider slowed sharply. Visually, she was at rest now. In truth, she was contained in a revolving object, one extremity of a bolo 4,000 kilometers long. Even though its revolution, seen from a distance, had looked ponderous, the bolo as a whole was wheeling fast enough to produce 2 G's of simulated gravity. That plus the 1 G of real gravity she was feeling from New Earth added up to a massive amount of downforce pressing her into the water-filled ballast sacks that made up the glider's belly. A human-sized grab, untroubled by the weight, dragged her glider off to the side, making way for other aircraft coming in for a landing behind. All told, the hangar collected 8 aircraft during this pass. Besides Cath-2's, 2 others were piloted by humans. Each was of a different design, both were powered. The other 5 were robot gliders, looking similar to Cath-2's, but solid rather than inflatable. As soon as the last of these was stowed, the hangar's tailgate constricted and closed behind them. Its stride complete, the hangar was already swinging back, gaining altitude heel first, rising back up toward space. It was much too large a volume to be pressurized. What little air it had scooped up during its dip into the atmosphere rapidly leaked out. So Cath-2 was effectively in outer space now. Knowing this, the fabric of the suit had contracted against her skin to supply the back pressure that was no longer provided by the atmosphere. It was porous, and so the only thing really between her skin and the void was space grease. The combined effects of that and the gnat mesh fooled her skin and muscles into believing that they were under a nice, thick blanket of air, the way humans were meant to live. The only part of the outfit that was pressurized, like an old-fashioned space suit, was the helmet. Dangling above the middle of the hangar's landing deck were 4 flivvers of various sizes and designs, the latest iterations of a vehicle type that had been in existence since before the onset of the hard rain. During the series of landings just completed, these had been kept up and out of the way. As soon as the door of the hangar closed, one of them, a medium-sized 4-passenger model, was lowered to the ramp by winches. It came to rest about 10 meters away. Incongruously for a space vehicle, it seemed to have wheels. It was, in fact, resting on a low-wheeled sled that was designed to roll up and down the ramp. Green lights beside the Flivver's airlock door told her that all was well on the other side. Kath, too, had about 10 minutes to reach it. That would be plenty of time if she didn't pass out. She issued a command that allowed the glider's body to deflate. She felt, rather than heard, the air escaping and the water draining. The soft top of the fuselage parted over her shoulders, back, butt, and thighs. Meanwhile, she was wriggling her arms in from the insulated sleeves, where they had been spread like a pair of wings. This was good exercise, given that they weighed 3 times as much as normal. By the time that was all done, the glider was just a wrinkled cross of fabric flat on the deck. Kath, too, disconnected herself from its air scrubber and its urine collection system, then unplugged the power and data from her collar. She gathered her arms under her and began to belly crawl toward the Flivver, sliding one knee, then the other forward along the deck plates like a lizard. A big sci-wy corkscrewed out and kept pace with her, tracking her vital signs, ready to supply extra air or other forms of assistance if needed. But Kath, too, made adequate progress. She probably could have crawled on hands and knees, as one of the other human pilots was doing, but she saw no need. Something strange caught her eye, and she went to the effort of rotating her head slightly just to verify it was real. The third pilot was actually walking upright. He was trudging along with short, deliberate strides, carefully judging his balance and the loads he was placing on his joints, while somehow managing to keep enough blood in his brain to remain conscious. Kath, too, could never have stood up, let alone walked, under 3 G's. The same was true of most of her race. This man, however, was a Teklin. That was obvious from his size, as well as his coloration and the shape of his head, which were visible through his helmet. It was hinted at by his musculature and by the style of the suit he was wearing. Heavier, partly armored, slung about with load-bearing straps made to support various burdens. His scabbards, holsters, and bandoliers were vacant. Even without any of those clues, however, she could have guessed his race from the fact that he had chosen to perform the feat of walking when he could have more safely and more easily crawled. Had it not been for the racial bond that joined Moirans and Teklins, Kath, too, might have rolled her eyes and muttered a joke about it. Teklins didn't need blood in their brains to keep dutifully trudging forward. Something along those lines. But that kind of stereotyping could just as well have been turned back on her. The Teklin had piloted his vehicle into the hangar under power. The thing had engines. Why not use engines if you belonged to a civilization that knew how to make them? Kath, too, on the other hand, had reached the same destination in an unpowered glider, using skill and wit to draw energy from the atmosphere. She could have turned pilot's duties over to an algorithm anytime she wanted. Instead, she had chosen to do most of it herself. In its own way, this was no less an act of pointless bravado than what the Teklin pilot was doing right now. She had been testing and sharpening a set of skills that was important to her. Mutatis mutandis, this Teklin was doing the same. Kath, too, got to the airlock with time to spare. Its floor was padded as a courtesy to people who, like her, were experiencing it through all the body's boniest parts. She rolled heavily onto her back, slightly bumping the pilot who had reached it on hands and knees, and connecting her air tube to a socket on the airlock wall. New air flooded her helmet. The Teklin entered and allowed himself to collapse onto a bench. The outer hatch closed and locked. The air pressure rose, and the gnat mesh reduced its fierce clutch on her body. It became no tighter than an athletic jersey, as the pressure approached 1 standard habitat atmosphere, a thinnish concoction of gases similar to what humans of old Earth had breathed in places like Aspen, Colorado. The inner hatch opened. Crawling now on hands and knees, Kath, too, followed the others into the main cabin, where 4 acceleration couches were waiting. They climbed into 3 of them, strapped in, and made themselves comfortable. They were now lying on their backs, legs elevated. At some point, their suit systems had found their way onto the Flivver's voice network. She knew as much from the fact that she could hear the other two breathing as heavily as she was. But no one said anything. Talking would become a lot easier in a few minutes. True to form, the Teclan, with a controlled exhalation, heaved his meaty arms up off the rests, grabbed his helmet, and pulled it off. He let its weight rest on his stomach and allowed his arms to thud back onto the couch. Kath, too, got a vague peripheral glimpse of platinum hair and cheekbones, as expected, but didn't feel like turning her head. Instead, she looked at a display screen mounted above her face, focusing as well as she could, with her eyeballs flattened into their sockets by G's. They had entered the hangar in level flight, traveling at 100 kilometers per hour. In the minutes since then, the centripetal force that had obliged her to crawl on the floor like a lizard had been accelerating them upward and forward, steadily pumping kinetic energy into them and everything around them, whirling them up into the immense velocities more typical of space travel. Compared to the Baroque, fire-breathing systems that their ancestors had used to the same purpose, there was nothing to it. The Bolo was mechanically identical to the sling used by David to slay Goliath. The Flivver was the stone nestled in its pocket. The Bolo had made about a quarter of a revolution, so they were now traveling directly away from the surface of the Earth, aimed toward the distant ring of habitats that they and the 3 billion other members of the human races called home. Seen on a video window in the display above, the hangar's tailgate dilated, showing a disk of black sky. A tattoo of metallic clunks let them know that the brakes on the sled had been released. Driven down the ramp by centripetal force, it built speed all the way to the lip of the hangar deck and then stopped short with a sneeze from its shock absorbers. The Flivver jerked free of the sled. From its occupant's point of view, it seemed to fall off the edge of the deck and into space. En route, it picked up a bit of a tumble, which was killed by quick firing of its thrusters. They became weightless. Kath, too, took her helmet off, but kept her head nestled in the couch's rest for a minute, while her inner ear adjusted. Meanwhile, she was groping in a compartment in her armrest for a VARP, which was what people normally used in place of flat-panel display screens when they wanted to interact with some kind of app. It was an old enough word that most people had forgotten it was an acronym for something like Vision Augmentation Retroprojector. Styles varied, but the baseline model looked like a heavy-framed pair of glasses. Mounted in that frame were cameras that could see the way her hands were moving, a microphone that could hear her speech, and other cameras that could track her gaze. A number of glowing figments appeared in her peripheral vision as she slipped them on, and she was able to reach out and activate one of them to launch Perambulator. This gave her a schema of the Flivver's situation in the universe. In the center, a blue disk representing New Earth, under a gray film of atmosphere. Well outside of that, the orbital track of the Bolo's center, the twin trajectories of its two hangars snaking around it. This was what they had just left behind. A blinking green dot showed their current location on their new orbit, a fat ellipse whose apogee coincided with the circle of habitats that hung above the planet at geosynchronous altitude. Over the next 12 hours, they would coast up to that height, then strap back into the couches and use other means to effect a delta V that would sync them up with whichever habitat they decided upon. The world in which essentially all 3 billion humans lived, as depicted from above, high over the North Pole, looking down on the whole system, was a hair-thin ring some 84,000 kilometers across, roughly 7 times the diameter of the blue and white planet in its center. The objects that made up the ring, though they seemed big to the humans who lived in them, were evanescent particles compared to the ring's overall scale. Imagine the thinnest possible jewelry chain, a nearly invisible trace of platinum around a woman's neck. Make a perfect circle of that same chain 10 meters in diameter, and that gives a picture of the ring's thinness in comparison to its overall size. It was more easily viewed in artificial renderings like the one on Kath-2's VARP, where the points that made up the ring, the individual habitats, were drawn as unrealistically large, color-coded pips. Seen that way, The circle was chopped into 8 arcs of roughly equal size, each subtending about 45 degrees. At long zoom, these were glinting and luminously iridescent, with much shorter gray arcs, the bone yards, they were called, sticking them together. At a closer zoom, the pointillistic nature of the image became obvious, and the system began helpfully to superimpose labels and number meridians. There were more than 9,000 active habitats distributed among those 8 segments. The bone yards contained another several hundred, mostly obsolete ones being cut up for scrap, as well as unused fragments of the moon and the odd captured asteroid, there to serve as raw material for new construction. Any object that was not inhabited, because it wasn't finished yet, because it was abandoned, or because it was just a rock, was rendered as a gray dot. This accounted for the dull appearance of the 8 boneyards. Sparkling with pure colors were the 8 much larger arcs between them. Seen from a distance, each arc had a predominant color. Encoded in those colors was the history of their building, and in turn, that of the human races during the last 1,000 years, the 5th millennium, the millennium of the Ring. Prior to that, during the first 4,000 years of the hard rain, space had been so dirty that the human races had obliged to hunker down in the shelter of massive nickel-iron bodies such as Cleft, whose orbits were, of course, similar to that of the moon, whose core had once comprised them, 9 times farther away from the Earth than the habitat ring was now. As Dubois-Harris had foreseen, the orbit of the former moon had been a fine place, the only place, really, to restart a civilization, as long as hellfire was raining down on Earth. But to the extent that the human race, as a whole, was capable of having a plan, it was to return to Earth, eventually. The hard rain diminished, gradually at first, and then, during the 4th millennium, more steeply as fleets of robots, issuing from their nickel-iron fastnesses like bats from caverns, began to sweep the skies clean, policing the rubble cloud, herding specks and pebbles together and spiraling them down into disciplined orbits at geosynchronous altitude. Most of the work was accomplished using the pressure of sunlight, a weak form of propulsion that took hundreds of years to have its effect. At the dawn of the 5th millennium, about 1,000 years ago, the first new habitat in geosynchronous orbit had been constructed. It was called Greenwich, because it was positioned above old Earth's prime meridian. In the way of neighbors, it at first had nothing but rubble and worn-out robots. As soon as Greenwich was complete, however, construction of more habitats had spread outward from it. The human races and their robots had begun burning their way through the ring of raw material in both directions, consuming it like fire on a fuse. Greenwich had been a joint project of all 7 human races. The same was true of its first neighbors. Volta, then Banu Qasim to the east, Atlas and Roland to the west, later Moor in both directions. All of these were, therefore, colored white in the display that Kath Tu was seeing in her VARP. Greenwich was one of 8 equidistant points plotted around the ring. The other 7, proceeding west, acquired the names Rio, Memphis, Pitcairn, Tokumaru, Kyoto, Dhaka, and Baghdad. In due course, each of them was seeded with a new habitat, as well as the production capabilities needed to manufacture more yet. As the centuries went by, their inhabitants likewise burned their way through the raw materials lying to their western and eastern sides, building new habitats at a pace to match the growth of their populations. It was self-evident that if the process went on long enough, the arc of habitats reaching west from, say, Greenwich, would make contact with that growing east from Rio. The increasingly narrow bands of unused material and recyclable junk between segments became the boneyards, and might have disappeared altogether had they not been so useful, in the early going as material depots, later as political buffers and as liminal zones, akin to frontiers, to which people could escape when they had learned that the close-packed life of space habitats was not for them. The one halfway between Greenwich and Rio was called Cape Verde. Other boneyards proceeding westward from Cape Verde were Titicaca, Grand Canyon, Hawaii, Kamchatka, Guangzhou, and Indus. Completing the circle, the one between Baghdad and Greenwich was called Balkans. Some were bigger than others. Guangzhou, which formerly had separated the Aydin and Kamite segments, had been used up entirely as the populations to either side had grown. When pronouncing her curse, Eve Aida had said much that was true. It had become clear within the first few generations after the Council of the Seven Eves that the seven races were going to be around forever. They were as permanent in the human picture as toenails and spleens. Though no official policy had ever been proclaimed to that effect, they had tended to vote with their feet. Rio had become predominantly Ivan. Moirans had flocked to Memphis, and Teclans to the next one around the arc in that direction, which was Pitcairn. Baghdad, flanking Greenwich on the other side, had been settled by Dinans. Proceeding east from Baghdad, Dhaka had filled up with Kamites. Aydins and Julians had found a way of expressing their perpetual sense of alienation from the other races by opting for the Antipodean habitats of Kyoto and Tokomaru, respectively. Closing the ring, this brought the Julians on their eastern end up against the Teclans' western extremity, separated only by the Hawaii Boneyard, which was relatively large, if only because the Julian race was not numerous enough to make much headway in using its resources. The levels of racial purity varied. Greenwich had been founded by all of them together, and so it would forever be the most diverse part of the ring. Baghdad and Rio, flanking it, also tended to have a lot of residents who were not, respectively, Dinans or Ivans. That three-segment arc was, therefore, fairly cosmopolitan. The other races, in general, tended to be more inward-looking, so their segments were not as thoroughly mixed. Anomalous outposts speckled the ring. A habitat containing 50,000 Julians located spang in the middle of the Dinan segment, for example. Eve Moira had employed a color-coding scheme to keep track of the lab samples from which all the races had spawned. It was purely the result of what she'd had lying around in the way of office supplies, an assortment of colored test tube stickers and felt-tipped pens. Nevertheless, it had become a universal convention. Blue, Dinah. Yellow, Camilla. Red, Aida. Orange, Julia. Cyan, Tekla. Purple, Moira herself. Green, Ivy. White, no particular race. The same code was used to render the dots that made up the ring. So a predominantly Dinan habitat would be colored blue, and so on. Because they were so tiny and so numerous, the dots all merged into an iridescent, sparkling arc on the screen. But general trends could be seen. Whether or not it had been a deliberate choice on Eve Moira's part, colors in the cool part of the palette, blue, green, purple, cyan, were linked to the four Eves she was personally closest to, while warm colors, red, yellow, orange, were saved for the others. When the entire ring was plotted according to this scheme, and the plot was viewed as a whole, with Greenwich at 12 o'clock and Tokomaru at 6, one therefore saw a great arc of cool colors starting at about 10 o'clock, the western end of the Indus Boneyard, and sweeping around to about 5 o'clock, the eastern end of the Hawaii Boneyard. A shorter arc of warm colors ran from a little before 6 o'clock to a little after 9. The ring's topmost segment, centered on Greenwich, was frosty white, like a polar ice cap flanked by purple mountains, green hills, and blue water. But on its bottom left side, the ring looked as if it were being heated by a blowtorch, glowing in the warm tones that spoke of predominantly Kamite, Aydin, and Julian populations. That segment was marked off, on the plot, by two red lines drawn athwart the ring. One was located at the longitude of 166 degrees, 30 minutes west, above the former Pacific island of Kiribati. This placed it near the eastern end of the Julian segment. The other was at precisely 90 degrees east, running through the habitat called Dhaka, in the exact center of the Kamites arc. The lines were borders, not just imaginary frontiers, but literal barriers that had been constructed, like turnpikes, across the ring. the warm-colored arc of habitats stretching between them, incorporating most of the Julian segment, all of the Aiden segment, and exactly half of the Kamide segment, was, to Kath Tu and the others aboard this flivver, another country. The relationship between it and the larger, cool-colored segment where they lived could be described in many possible ways, of which the most succinct was war. The Teklin, seeing that Kath Tu had lifted her head from the rest and thereby joined the temporary society of the flivver, turned toward her. He stuck his right elbow out to the side, made a blade of his hand, palm down, and snapped it in until his thumbnail was touching the point of his chin. Then, after a moment's pause, elevated it to the level of his forehead. "Belid Tomov," he said. But Kath Tu had already known this, since it was stenciled on the outside of his suit. Kath Tu made a similar gesture, though in the style of her race she used her left hand and kept the palm toward her, fingers curled into a loose fist. "Kath Amalthova, too." Both of them looked toward the Dynan. During the previous moments, he had kept his gaze averted in a way that, as everyone understood, meant that he had been taking a leak into his suit's urine collection system and wanted privacy. But now he looked up and performed the gesture, also left-armed, with a slight variation in the attitude of the hand, beginning with his palm toward him but flipping it over to face outward as he brought it to his forehead. "Rhys Alaskov." This style of greeting was a throwback to the early days of the Cloud Ark and the first generation spawned on Cleft by the Seven Eves. People then had spent a lot of time in spacesuits equipped with outer visors that could be flipped up or down to compensate for sunlight. When the visor was pulled down, it concealed the wearer's face behind a reflective, metallized screen. When it was pushed up, the face could be seen. In the crowded environments of those days, the upward movement of the hand had become a signal meaning, "Hello, I'm available for social interaction," and its reverse had come to mean, "Goodbye," or "I wish for privacy now." These gestures' practical necessity had withered away as the human races had spread out into habitats where they could get privacy whenever they desired it. They lived on, however, as salutes. Belid Tomov had opted for military style, using the right hand, the subtext being, "I am not going to kill you with a concealed weapon." In gravity, the next move might have then be to reach out for a handshake. In zero-G, this usually wasn't practical, and so was rarely done. The left-handed version suggested a non-military vocation, implying that the saluter's right hand was busy doing something useful. The variations in hand position were racial, and their origins were the subject of folkloric research. All agreed, however, that they were useful for signaling one's race when far away, or when obscured in a spacesuit. The cues in size, shape, posture, and bearing that distinguished the races could be subtle, particularly when it was not possible to see facial features and hair color. Rhys Alaskov had the honey hair and freckled skin typical of a Dynan. Teklins, too, were fair. But where Rhys had an open, appealing face and an engaging manner, Belid was all cheek and jawbones, sleek and bony at the same time, eyes so blue they were nearly white, hair like fiber-optic glass, cropped close to his skull. His effect matched his look. Kath, too, was dark brown, with green eyes and woolly black hair. Close, in other words, to the way Eve Moira had looked. Among the three in this flivver, the largest contrast was therefore between her and Belid. And yet 5,000 years of acculturation shaped the way they would interact. If some crisis were to arise, Kath Tu and Belid would likely find themselves back to back, each instinctively seeking qualities wanted in the other. And in the absence of a crisis, they might find themselves front to front. A similar complementary relationship obtained between Dynans and Ivans, but as it happened, Rhys Alaskov was without an opposite number at the moment, that empty fourth couch. All of which, and more, was just subtext, passed over in a fraction of a second. Rhys pushed off gently and floated toward the nest of displays that served as the flivver's control panel. The same functions, of course, might have been served within his VARP, but it was considered desirable to make the ship's status clearly visible to everyone in the cabin, and so that kind of information tended to be splashed up on large screens. Reese was going to establish contact with whatever habitat was at their apogee, chat up whoever was answering the phone on the other end, and smooth the way in general. While he was floating slowly across the cabin, he said, "I trust you both had good surveys?" "Nominal," Bellet announced. Kath, too, was about to make a remark in the same vein when she remembered the Indigen, or whoever it was, watching her glider from the shelter of the trees by the lake. The impression had been so fleeting. Had she imagined it? She was certain she hadn't. But memory could play funny tricks. "Mine was fascinating," Reese said, when Kath too failed to take the bait for a while. "Any irregularities?" asked Bellet, just as Kath too was saying, "What was so interesting?" Sensing Bellet's gaze on her, Kath too turned his way and understood that his question had been aimed as much at her as at Reese. It was in Reese's nature as a Dynan, however, to assume that the question was all for him. His eyes flicked between Kath too and Bellet. Knowing he was the odd man out here, he responded with a grin that was, of course, charming. "I think I can answer both questions at once." He had reached the chair centered in the cockpit. "The Canids are going epi in a huge way. They've become nearly unrecognizable." He brought the controls to life with a few sweeps of his fingers, and the screens lit up all around him. A Canid was a thing like a dog, wolf, or coyote. Rather than trying to bring back individual species, Dr. Noah, had drawn inspiration from research that had emerged in old Earth scientific journals shortly before Zero, suggesting that the boundaries among those commonly recognized species were so muddy as to be meaningless. They all could and did mate with each other and produce hybrid offspring. For various reasons, these tended to group by size and shape in a way that human observers saw as being distinct species. But when humans weren't looking, or when the environment shifted, all manner of coy dogs and coy wolves and wolf dogs appeared. Coyotes began hunting in packs like wolves, or wolves went solo like coyotes. Creatures that had avoided or eaten humans struck up partnerships with them. Family pets went feral. Hu Noah was 120 years old. As a young man, he had been one of many scientists who had rebelled against a tradition of terraform thought that had passed as gospel for hundreds of years previously. Thanks in part to the Young Turk's propagandizing, this older approach had become hidebound and stereotyped as the TOT, or Take Our Time, school. The premise of Tot was that ecosystems, which on old Earth had evolved over hundreds of millions of years, would have to be rebuilt slowly, through a sort of handcrafting process. Which was fine, since living in habitats was safer and more comfortable anyway than the unpredictable surface of a planet. The human races could enjoy thousands of years of safe, secure habitat life while slowly recreating ecosystems down below that would resemble those of old Earth. The planet would become a sort of ecological preserve. Africa, whose outlines were still vaguely recognizable, though heavily reshaped by the hard rain, would have giraffes and lions sequenced from the ones and zeros dating all the way back to the thumb drive around Eve Moira's neck. Likewise with the other battered and reforged continents. Doc was the last surviving member of the Young Turk faction that had named, then rubbished, the Tot Lot. They were called the GID, or Get It Done, school. Their leader had been Luke Markov, who himself had been over 100 years old when he had become Doc's teacher. Obviously from his name, which was taken from the surname of Eve Dinah's boyfriend, Marcus, Luke had been a Dinan. But Doc and most of his followers were Ivans, which gave them an air of seriousness and credibility that had proved useful in pressing their agenda. They had formed a partnership with mostly Moiran philosophers who had begun questioning the Tot Lot's premises, pointing out that recreating simulacra of old Earth biomes, in addition to taking an unreasonably long time, reflected a basically sentimental way of thinking about nature. It was an expression of a sort of post-traumatic stress disorder that the human races had carried on their backs ever since the hard rain. It was time to discard that. The old ecosystems would never return. Even if it were possible to bring them back, it would take so long as to not be worth it. In any event, and this was the nail in the coffin, supplied personally by Doc, it would fail anyway, because the forces of natural selection were unpredictable and uncontrollable. The most powerful weapon in the Gid school's arsenal, however, was not philosophy. It was impatience, a failing shared to a greater or lesser degree by all the races. Second only to that was a competitiveness, a quality absent in Kamites, but present in the other six. Anyone so motivated would of course want to get it done, to make the terraform happen in centuries rather than millennia. Their rise to power had, however, produced political consequences they had never imagined by giving the races something to compete for, namely, territory on the surface of New Earth. In the early 4820s, Luke Markov had published papers speculating that the surface of New Earth could be made ready for permanent human habitations as early as 5050. While that was startlingly soon by the standards of the Take Our Time school, it had seemed far in the future to the average person, and so the Council of Scientists responsible for planning the terraform had seen no problem with enshrining it in the schedule, and later even moving it up to 5005, the anniversary of the landing on Cleft. But the shift in thinking had unleashed long-pent-up political forces that had led to the formation of what amounted to two different countries in the year 4830. The Aedans, who dominated one of them, bringing many Kamites and Julians under their sway, had built the turnpikes at Kiribati and Dhaka in 4855, cleaving the ring. They eventually came up with a formal name for their country, obliging the rest of the ring to come up with a name for theirs, but everyone simply called them Red and Blue. Terraform had continued anyway, through ad hoc cooperation between scientists and labs, straddling the red-blue borders. 23 years later, however, practically as soon as New Earth's atmosphere had become breathable without artificial aids, had begun the War on the Rocks, a struggle carried out partly in space, but mostly on the still nude surface of New Earth. This had been terminated in 4895 by what was now called First Treaty, which stipulated, among other things, how subsequent terraform activity was going to proceed. It had thus paved the way for the Great Seeding, which was responsible for the trees that Cath-2 had been flying over this morning. In subsequent decades, larger and larger animals had been set loose on the surface as part of a planned program to jumpstart whole ecosystems. Some of those, the ones Cath-2 had been worried about this morning, were canids. When Rhys said that they were going epi, he meant that they were passing through some kind of epigenetic shift. If the agent had blown up the moon a couple of decades earlier, Eve Moira wouldn't have known about epigenetics. It was still a new science at the time she was sent up to the Cloud Ark. During her first years in space, when she and her equipment had been coddled in the most protected zones of Izzy and Endurance, she'd had plenty of time to bone up on the topic. Like most children of her era, she'd been taught to believe that the genome, the sequence of base pairs expressed in the chromosomes in every nucleus of the body, said everything there was to say about the genetic destiny of an organism. A small minority of those DNA sequences had clearly defined functions. The remainder seemed to do nothing, and so were dismissed as junk DNA. But that picture had changed during the first part of the 21st century, as more sophisticated analysis had revealed that much of that so-called junk actually performed important roles in the functioning of cells by regulating the expression of genes. Even simple organisms, it turned out, possessed many genes that were suppressed or silenced altogether by such mechanisms. The central promise of genomics, that by knowing an organism's genome, scientists could know the organism, had fallen far short, as it had become obvious that the phenotype, the actual creature that met the biologist's eye with all of its observable traits and behaviors, was a function not only of its genotype, its DNA sequences, but also of countless nano-decisions being made from moment to moment within the organism's cells by the regulatory mechanisms that determined which genes to express and which to silence. Those regulatory mechanisms were of several types, and many were unfathomably complex. Had it not been for the sudden intervention of the agent, the biologists of old Earth would have devoted at least the remaining decades of the century to cataloging these mechanisms and understanding their effects, a then-new science called epigenetics. Instead of which, on Cleft, in the hands of Eve Moira and the generations of biologists she reared, it became a tool. They had needed all the tools they could get, and they had wielded them pragmatically, bordering on ruthlessly, to ensure the survival of the human races. When creating the children of the other six Eves, Moira had avoided using epigenetic techniques. She had felt at liberty, however, to perform some experiments on her own genome. It had gone poorly at first, and her first eight pregnancies had been failures. But her last, the only daughter of Moira to survive, had flourished. Cantabrigia, as Moira had named her after the University of Cambridge, had founded the race of which Cath II was a member. By the time the Great Seeding was in the works, thousands of years later, epigenetics was sufficiently well understood to be programmed into the DNA of some of the newly created species that would be let loose on the surface of New Earth. And one of the planks in the Get It Done platform was to use epigenetics for all it was worth. So rather than try to sequence and breed a new subspecies of coyote that was optimized for, and that would breed true in, a particular environment, as the Tott School would have had it, the GID approach was to produce a race of canines that would, over the course of only a few generations, become coyotes or wolves or dogs, or something that didn't fit into any of those categories, depending on what happened to work best. They would all start with a similar genetic code, but different parts of it would end up being expressed or suppressed, depending on circumstances. And no particular effort would be made by humans to choose and plan those outcomes. They would seed New Earth and see what happened. If an ecosystem failed to take in a particular area, they would just try something else. In the decades since such species had been seeded onto New Earth, this had been going on all the time. Epigenetic transformation had been rampant and, since survey was thin on the ground, largely unobserved by humans. Still, when it led to results that humans saw and happened to find surprising, it was known as going epi. Use of the phrase was discouraged for being unscientific, but Rhys Alaskov knew how to get away with it. Rhys brought up a rendering of the habitat ring and zoomed in on the whitish segment at its top. Their projected route was superimposed as a crisp green arc that curled through apogee near a succession of relatively small habitats just to the east of Greenwich. For the first habitats constructed in each segment, close to the seeds of Greenwich, Rio, et al., had naturally tended to be smaller than the ones that came along later, when the construction process had hit its stride. The closer to a boneyard you got, the larger the habitats generally became. As Rhys panned and zoomed around, habitat names came and went on the screen. Hannibal, Brussels, Oyo, Auvergne, Vercingetorix, Steve Lake. The latter aroused a flicker of interest. Cath One had had an old friend living there, but the friendship wouldn't likely have survived the transition to Cath Two. She brought the same thing up on her VARP and zoomed out to remind herself of the current location of the eye. If the habitat ring as a whole was like the dial of a clock, then the eye, with its inner and outer tethers, one depending toward Earth, the other reaching out beyond the habitat ring, was a hand. Any description of the eye had to begin by mentioning that it was the largest object ever made. Most of its material had come from Cleft. It was, in a sense, the thing Cleft had ultimately shape-shifted into. Its innermost piece was a spinning, ring-shaped city of sufficient diameter, some 50 kilometers, that even the largest space habitats could pass through its center with plenty of room to spare. This made the eye capable of sweeping all the way around the ring, encompassing in turn each of the 10,000 separate habitats. Or at least that had been the original plan. In practice, its sweep was limited to the blue part of the ring that began at Dhaka and ran westward about two-thirds of the way around the ring to the fringe of the Julian segment. At both of those locations, barriers, literal turnpikes, consisting of long splinters of nickel iron laid directly across the ring, had been constructed by Red to physically block movement of the eye into their segment. So instead of sweeping around like the hand of a clock, it bounced back and forth between the turnpikes, confining itself to blue habitats. During the ensuing century and a half, Red had been at work on something huge that appeared to be an anti-eye in the making, and that would presumably sweep back and forth in like manner over their segment.